When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
One of our favorite ways to learn, besides reading, of course, is by streaming The Great Courses Plus. Watch and listen to over 10,000 lectures from award-winning experts as they explore fascinating people, places, and ideas. We recommend checking out a new course from The Great Courses Plus, Sci-Fi, Science Fiction as Philosophy. Philosophy is the search for truth, and sometimes that truth is best revealed through fiction. The Great Courses Plus is giving our listeners a fantastic limited-time offer. Get your first month free, plus receive the second month for only 99 cents. That's unlimited access to enjoy their huge library of engaging lectures for 2 full months for under a dollar. To get this exclusive offer, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/bookriot. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/bookriot. Thanks to them for sponsoring this week's show.
This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 285. We're recording on Thursday, November 1st. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. I'm here with Jeff O'Neill. We're coming to you from bookriot.com.
I almost freaked out because the copy was wrong. You read the copy as I'm Jeff O'Neill. I was like, wait, oh, wait, that's right.
You know, I've done it, I think, at least once. I just ran straight.
I'm Jeff O'Neill. I didn't even notice it. Just went flying by. We've had a week. It's been a busy week. It's Halloween.
It has been a week, you know. October lasted forever.
Yeah.
I felt like.
Oh, yeah, finally it's over. A long October. That's true.
It has been a week.
Part of the longness we can say is that it's a Rebecca Shinsky joint, but I was a part of it. Annotated November episode is up today. So the last, well, you've been working on it for a while, but you know, the last week or so when we're doing edits and getting the thing published, always makes it an interesting week. The end of the month now is extremely interesting. A lot of other stuff going on in the world.
That's true.
But we had that go checked out. The title of that one, I guess, they're all the annotated episodes are pretty interesting, I'd say, for Book Riot podcast listeners. This one maybe more than most. We do some methodology cornerish types of things. It's called "Is Reading Endangered?" You can go find that. I'll put a link in the show notes there. You can find Apple Podcasts. Go check it out. Rebecca, you did a good job with it. It's a tough one.
It was right in the wheelhouse, of a bunch of things that I'm interested in. Anybody who's been listening to this show for a while will not be surprised that this was a thing I had a lot of fun digging into and writing.
Let's see. I guess we're going to get to follow-up down in a minute. So let's do a sponsor, and then we'll get cooking.
You got it. So our first sponsor this week is Weregirl Typhon by C.D. Bell. This tells the story of three sisters who are together for the first time since birth. Nessa Kurland, a werewolf with powers she has learned to control. Delphine, who grew up knowing there was more to their family's story than was being said. And finally, the Chimera, known as CM, a construction of their father's living lab, whose very existence threatens them all. And a storm is coming. When Nessa is faced with the ultimate choice, will everyone make it out alive? Booklist raves, the drama won't let up. A fast-paced, intelligent story that explores what defines a human being is from Forward. This is a superhero origin story with a feminist twist. It's breaking tradition from the typical superhero mold. Weregirl introduces a heroine who is strong, tough, and gutsy even before her magical transformation, and who relishes and embraces the powers her werewolfism brings her. There's friendship and romance, science and magic. Weregirl Typhon by C.D. Bell is available wherever books are sold, and you can find a link to it in the show notes.
It's follow-up time. Good follow-up this week. Moira Donegan, who we've talked about over time, but especially of late as Stephen Elliott brought his defamation suit against her for being creator. I know you're going to be surprised that I'm quibbling with the idea of creator, of a definition of a word that no one else cares about but me. Did she create the list? I guess she hosted it. She put the structure together. I mean, I think that's part of what goes to the core of the defamation idea. It's like she hosted it. She put together the framework. She let other people know about it. Signed a deal to sell a book about The description, I think, is interesting. This is a quote from the Publishers Weekly article that will be in the show notes. The perfect introduction to the political and moral challenges of the Me Too movement. So I think it's going to deal with the thorniness, as Donegan herself all too is. I think if anything, it would be better to have a specific title of a book to say she's the author of rather than of this shitty media man. Like everything about her now has an appositive saying creator of, originator of this shitty media men list, just because it's an unfortunate title, but it's also sort of a negative.
Well, I think it's also too, in a way, it's too small.
Right.
Like what
yes,
she really,
exactly. That's
what
right.
she did was, it's not like she just made a Google Doc
right.
and called it a day. Like that, it almost minimizes it to call her creator of the shitty media men list. Like what she has done is facilitate first a place for women to tell women and men for survivors of sexual harassment and sexual assault to tell their stories. And then facilitated the breaking out of that conversation that has led to, you know, some reckoning in the public sphere about these behaviors. I don't think there's like, this was an activist act to
yes,
take, but
agreed.
I don't know if she thinks of herself as an activist. I would describe like what she has done is certainly a form of activism, but we don't have a good word here. I agree with you that like just the quick one line bio of like this is Maura Donegan and she's the creator of the shitty media men list doesn't give you the full story or a good sense of really the work that she's doing. And so I'm for a lot of reasons glad that she's getting this book deal, but a chance to be considered in a bigger way for hopefully like the breadth of the work and the impact of the work that she's doing and to really tell the whole story.
This is a hyperbole, which is exaggeration for effect, but it'd be like saying Charles Darwin, the author of The Origin of Species, right?
Right.
That's true. It's factually correct, but like...
but like it doesn't convey
the impact. Capture
the
whole thing. Right.
Right.
So that it doesn't say anything about when the book is coming out. I'm guessing they're going to try to be quick, but don't hurry, to use a John Woodenism about it. But, you know, we talked about the Streisand effect on a recent show. She's also has the opposite of the Streisand effect, this Elliot lawsuit. No one was talking about a book deal for her, as I heard, before this. I mean, maybe there was, but it is interesting that after the suit came out, we've had a couple of, you know, the GoFundMe for her legal campaign and then the high-profile representation and now a book deal. So good job, Stephen Elliott. I'm sure you're getting exactly what you were bargaining for with this particular suit.
Yeah, you know, I would bet just knowing how canny literary agents are that probably as soon as her name was attached to this and it was clear it was going to be a story, she was being approached for things. Just related to books around Me Too, if you have read Good and Mad by Rebecca Traister you've been following it, I'm sure she's doing a lot of media, but I heard a great interview with her on the Forever 35 podcast, which is hosted by Dori Shafrir, formerly of BuzzFeed, and Kate Spencer. And the show is about self-care and all kinds of self-care and often ranges into like beauty routines and regimens, but they have an interesting guest every time around. And Rebecca Traister was on a recent episode talking about how Good and Mad got written and talking about the function of women's anger in society and about the Me Too movement in the context of that. So there's some interesting stuff in there about the publishing process and like how she intended to write this book and then how quickly she ended up writing it and how it took shape. But for folks following it, also an interesting frame of looking at women's anger and expression of anger as an act and method of self-care, which is not what this show is about, but I think is worth mentioning. So there it is.
So watching that, fascinating to see. I mean, Donegan it's not one of those situations where people are going to write a book that's like a compendium of their public the statements and interviews and essays about a particular topic. She hasn't said that much publicly, I think, for reasons that make a lot of sense. As you're canny to point out that our traditional mental model of an activist is hard to map onto her. She did something, I think she took a specific action, the creation of this list that she thought would do good. She felt motivated to do it. I guess an activist idea would be you're doing something with the idea of a more wide-ranging systemic kind of a change. This felt more like almost a life jacket situation of like, we need a list of dudes to avoid, right? Like,
yeah.
And if it doesn't do anything more than that, it'll be a good in itself, where an activist is really trying to change a structure or a law or something like that.
Yeah, I think the goalpost probably moved
for
this.
Oh, sure, yes,
that,
of course.
You know, that, yeah, that you're right, that it started as essentially a formalized, recorded document version of the Whisper Network. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you get the information if you're not talking to all the right people? Or, like, in publishing, there is a thing that I've noticed during the Me Too stuff about, like, the folks who live in New York and encounter mm-hmm. all the rest of the publishing industry in New York on a regular basis seem to have a very strong Whisper Network. If you live outside New York or you're not talking to people who live in New York that often, like, you may have encounters with people that, that you would have wished you had known this piece of framing about them prior. And so she created that way to, you know, record and share knowledge about knowledge and experiences. And then when it got out, the, like, what do we do with this and what does it mean? And is a different, mm-hmm. like that became a different beast.
Yeah.
The sort of the intention, the original intention, and then the ultimate intention of it, I think really did shift. I am really looking forward to hearing, the book is about dealing with sexual harassment, but I would assume there's going to be a lot of her in it. And, I'm really looking forward to hearing about that, about her experience doing this.
Are you ready? Can I bother you with a hey, did you know thing sort of related to this?
Oh, Jeff, a hey, did you know is never.
And this is also the kind of question you really can't say. It's going to happen no matter what you say. I'm so sorry about
right.
this, right? It's like,
I'm ready. I'm ready.
So, you know, that thing you're saying about the physical proximity to the seat of power around publishing matters. Like, kinds of information mm-hmm. gets communicated interpersonally, being around in the halls of power as regards, you know, there's no better historical example than Versailles and Louis XIV, right? Basically, Versailles held all the royalty because they wanted to be around Louis XIV because it was so powerful. And the phrase we have for, you know, something can't hold a candle to something as being it's not as good as, not as powerful as, because whoever held Louis XIV's candle when he was going to bed had sort of the greatest amount of influence on Louis XIV, and that's where the phrase you can't hold a candle to comes from.
I love a linguistic, hey, did you know?
Right. You know, this is what happens.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's not bad, right? Like, if you had asked me before, I don't even remember where I read this, but I remember thinking at the same time, it's like, I've never even thought about that phrase, hold a candle to, because it's nonsensical. Like, holding candles next to things? Like, why
right,
has
that's
it
one
to do
of those
power?
That, like, right, like an alien lands, and you have to explain,
yeah,
why
right.
do we say it
yeah,
this way?
Totally. Yeah.
I have no idea. I've also never interrogated the origin of that phrase.
Yeah, my daughter Rowan this morning asked me, like, said, you know, we said, you know, they're up for having pizza. Mm. And she's like, what does that mean? I was like, well, they're willing to do it. It's like, why do you say up for? I'm like,
and you could also say they're down
for
it.
Yeah,
they're
down for it. They're up off the couch. They're down off the bunk. But I had nothing.
Thumbs. They gave it the thumbs up.
Yeah.
Like, man, this is one of the reasons I would be such. I would like screw a child up is because I would just make up story.
Yeah. Sure. Anyway, so there's your hold the candle, your linguistic history, geopolitical.
That's a good one.
Speaking of
hallways
of
power.
Speaking of corrupt hallways of power, let's go over our friends at the ampersand, as I refer to them, Barnes & Noble. As we anticipated, this lawsuit is going away quietly with... I'm kidding.
I was like, wait, that's not what it says, Jeff.
Barnes & Noble has now filed a counterclaim against Demos Parneros, saying, I'm not, but what are you? What bounces off me sticks to you, I believe is the specific legal language.
It's I'm rubber
and
you're glue.
You're glue. Yeah. Basically saying, we are not the ones that are the bigger jerks here. You are the bigger jerks. Saying in a counterclaim that he sexually harassed people in the workplace, also did some very specific things to preserve his position as a CEO by undermining the acquisition talks, which we quibbled about what, you know, a book retailer was. BNN and lawyers now allege that Parneros didn't just botch the sale of the company this past summer, but actively derailed it, apparently in an effort to preserve his position as a CEO. I guess the thinking being whatever company bought them would either install their own CEO as the CEO of the newly formed mm-hmm. company, or as a part of the rearrangement, say, you know, we don't want this Parneros dude. We're going to bring in our own coach to call the plays, and he didn't want that. That's their allegation. I mm-hmm. guess it could make sense. I don't know.
Yeah. There's so a
this
story
isn't just
here.
this isn't just the legal defense they're mounting against his lawsuit, I should say. I don't think I hit that hard enough. They're counter suing him.
Right.
For legal fees, but also to claw back some of his salary and stuff that was happened during this time. So it's a messier, is I guess.
It's so messy, and it's the stuff of like it would make a great scene in a movie about corporate chicanery, you know, that he's portrayed as reluctant and even defiant, and like that things come to a head after he's been, you know, interfering with and undermining this due diligence process. Things come to a head at a disastrous meeting on June 18th, which the purchaser, this mysterious purchaser or intended purchaser that we don't know who it was, but it was probably not Walmart because they're not a book retailer. Gotta get my digs in while
weird.
I can.
I thought it was weird that was mentioned in this article. It was very specific of them to say.
That they had called in part, the meeting had been called in part to get a handle on the recent sales decline at Barnes & Noble. So Pernero is probably here, not just reluctant and defiant, but feeling threatened because they're analyzing a sales decline and who's on the hook for that, if not the CEO. And that at the meeting, the Barnes & Noble lawyers alleged that Parneros went on this long, rambling monologue. He failed to address issues and questions that were posed by the potential acquirer. He portrayed the company in an extremely and unduly negative light, that he described Barnes & Noble as a, quote, ugly mess, and that said the company had no talent before he arrived. Man, that's like, this is an outburst that would be fun to watch on screen, but horrifying in person.
Well, and verifiable. Theoretically, you could subpoena the
everybody that was in
the
room
and they could say, right? I mean, it's not just, that's not a he said, she said necessarily. I mean, if there's more than three people, I guess.
And there are sexual harassment claims that Barnes & Noble details now in this counterclaim, in this countersuit, in which a female employee reported two incidents in which she was subjected to unwanted touching and or unwanted comments of a sexual nature by Parneros. And these are the ones that Parneros referred to in his suit as a misunderstanding, basically. But this is an interesting picture of this guy to be painting. And that's what Barnes & Noble is doing here, I think, is look, this is a person, as they're saying, who, you know, not just resisted that this was happening at the company, but actively worked to undermine it. This like ego language around like that he's portraying the company as a mess, that he's saying there was no talent there before he arrived, kind of jives with our idea about also the kind of guy who would abuse his position and be a sexual harasser. And that's not to say that we can prove any of this, but this does add up to a picture that makes some sense to me. I can see where Barnes & Noble is going here. It seems plausible.
And again, as you know, I'm not a prosecutor, a defense attorney, a trial lawyer, or really know anything other than, really anything about the law, I should say. But boy, this doesn't seem like the kind of thing you do if you've got a seven of hearts and a two of spades, right?
Right.
You know, it doesn't feel like that to me.
Yeah, this is, I don't think that this is a bluff.
No. Also, if anyone out there has any pull with John Carreyrou and who's looking for a project.
Yes. Corporate chicanery.
I didn't have to be a full book, a long Wall Street Journal article, a long New Yorker thing. Like
an
the Theranos
of
publishing is super interesting to me. They actually do sell books that actually you can buy. So it's not that.
They're not perpetrating industry-wide fraud.
But this boardroom mud fight. You're right. It's a very theatrical scene that Barnes & Noble is describing. Fascinating to look at. I don't know what else to say. I was a little shocked. Publishers Weekly, I should say, you know, sometimes you notice the meta stuff, but Publishers Weekly, very, I would say, if anything, they are droll and stoic about this, these kinds of reporting. And they have this modifying phrase that opens a claim, in a stunning claim, comma. And I noticed that to say, wow, even Publishers Weekly is saying it's a stunning claim. Like, you know, the amplitude on the reactions tend to be lower than mine to stuff like this.
Yeah.
So to see that ripple, I was like, whoa, it is a big deal. It's not just me. I haven't just had too much Frosted Flakes this morning.
Well, and I think like we swim in the water of thinking about these things all the time, and we think about Barnes & Noble so much that it's easy to lose a little perspective on how shocking or not something that is happening specifically, like anything in the industry that you just live in, but specifically with something as that we talk about as much as we talk about Barnes & Noble, and having some validation of like, right, this is stunning. These are very theatrical, like appalling behaviors, and not, they may be more common than they should be, but really not common in the regular everyday conducting of business. Yeah. But it also goes away. Like if these stories are true, that goes some distance to explain why Barnes & Noble has not been doing so well.
Yeah, no,
if this is who the CEO is and the kind of way that he does his job, like,
he's like negging his own company to not Walmart in front of other people. Like it's wild stuff.
to not Walmart. And it is wild stuff. It really is. And I think that that's why thinking about what that scene must have looked like if it really happened that way, you know, if all the alleged things occurred as they're told, this is really amazing. This is not a thing that happens just when you go to work every day.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't. But like maybe it makes it a little bit less mysterious. There's less head scratching about like why Barnes & Noble can't figure things out if this is what's happening at the highest ranks over there.
Right, because when we saw these claims that he was undermining the acquisition, I mean, that could be very subtle, even if true.
Right.
And also indeterminate, ambiguous kinds of things that in the claim, if we read something like this and it was a different situation where he... I don't know, didn't put his back into pitching the company or didn't go along with company strategy. That's one where you could read it a couple of different ways. Saying the company was a mess, there's no talent. And this article says that this potential acquirer, this not Walmart, they canceled the dinner they were supposed to have that night. And then the next day said, we're out. Like it was, there's a very sort of, the timeline suggests a causality that if true would be difficult to hand wave and say it wasn't
right
related.
And could also be verified.
Yep.
You know, like those people can be the people from not Walmart can be asked for their account of what happened and the causality. Like we don't, at some point you get to stop making inferences.
Yes.
And if, you know, if this thing goes to court, if they don't settle, which I would be shocked if it went to court, like, you know,
but we needed to go to court, Rebecca. Do you know why?
So we can go.
No, well, there's one specific reason.
Tell me.
Because they'll subpoena not Walmart. And we'll know who it is.
And it won't be Walmart, and I will be right.
God, what if it was Walmart? We'd have to shut the podcast down. That's it. That'd be the last episode. Do another sponsor. That's your reward for being right. Let's do another sponsor.
Okay. Our next sponsor this week is Darkest Star by Jennifer L. Armentrout. In the world of the Lux, secrets thrive, lies shatter, and love is undeniable. 17-year-old Evie Dasher knows firsthand the devastating consequences of humanity's war with the aliens. Drawn into a world she doesn't understand, she finds herself confronted by long-buried secrets, a betrayal that could tear her life apart, and you knew this was coming, a guy who is not what he appears.
Yeah.
Her growing attraction to him promises danger. Can Evie dare to love? Jennifer L. Armentrout is a number one New York Times, USA Today, and internationally best-selling author. She brings her trademark drama and intrigue to a new romantic YA science fiction series with The Darkest Star. It features Armentrout's most swoon-worthy book boyfriend yet. This is a brand new series set in the same world as The Lux with a completely new story and characters. So if you know The Lux books, you're going to get a little, you know, another hit of that world. If you don't, that's fine. You're going to get brand new characters and a story. You don't need to know anything going in. It's perfect for new readers and for returning fans. Visit TorTeen, that's TORTEEN.com, to learn more about The Darkest Star by Jennifer L. Armentrout and more great reads. And again, that is The Darkest Star by Jennifer L. Armentrout, also available wherever books are sold.
Yeah, I thought I had it in the more follow-up. I thought I put it in the agenda, but either I deleted it or got moved around or I had went into a fugue state. Some follow-up about our Indigo talk. Last week, a lot of feedback about the Indigo talk. Not surprisingly, some of it was, you know, reaction, is this cool or isn't cool? And, you know, sort of our meta commentary about, like, how do we feel about this as the future of book selling, you know, kind of going nuts with that as a taking it to its logical but absurd conclusion there. But factual stuff too from the Canadians, who have been very helpful in framing, is this representative of indigos writ large in Canada, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like this kind of super high end, mostly if not entirely non discounting and this kind of shopping. And they said no, that from the by and large, the feedback we got from our Canadian listeners was this was markedly more higher end of experience than they would expect from walking into your, any indigo you might walk into in Canada. That there's certainly, it looks familiar, but the at least the patina of fancy is ratcheted up quite a bit in this particular. So I thought that was interesting. Also, some more information about Short Hills itself, and the mall. Short Hills is affluent, but also affluent beyond affluent is, some of the feedback we got too of, the average price for a house there is like $1.5 million, that kind of stuff.
Oh, so we're like, we have really exceeded bougie AF at this
point.
Yeah,
I think this is 1% territory. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what percentage threshold bougie AF tops out at. Does it go all the way to the top, or is there sort of a... It seems to me there's a sort of a striving level implicit in bougie, like you're upwardly mobile, you're aspirational. Mm-hmm. Short Hills is the kind of place that if you're bougie, you aspire to, right? Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. Now, that doesn't mean that Indigo's American strategy will not be just a series of stores in the most affluent zip codes, but it does suggest that it also might not be. That this, if it were ever going to be a non-representative fancy on the more than two standard deviations away from what they would do on average, this certainly would be the place to do it. So, one data point, that's our problem with one data point, right? Is it's a single right. data. It's either indicative or non-indicative, and you can't figure it out yet. I think it's interesting, though, what is not, negotiable is if this is where they started. Yeah. And I'd love to know the thinking about that.
That is interesting.
If it's not indicative of their strategy, then why start there? I guess that would be my question. Because if it's indicative of your strategy, well, then okay, then you're going to be in malls like this. But if you're not going to be exclusively or largely in malls like this, then why this one?
Well, are you starting there because you're high end and that's a high end neighborhood, and so this one is a pretty guaranteed hit? Or are they, I think that's the question I have, is were they looking to start in a place that would be a high likelihood of success? Or were they looking to start somewhere where they could answer some questions about where they could go with this? And this looks to me like you put your high end store at your top end of bouginess, or even just straight up aspirational shopping centers, when you feel pretty confident, like that gives you a high confidence index that like these are the customers, they're going to spend money, this location will likely be successful. It feels meaningfully different to me from the confusion that we feel about all of Amazon's things, where it's like, what are they doing? And it's like, clearly they're trying to answer some question. And we can't get, like, we don't know what the question is. This from Indigo, that location doesn't look to me like trying to answer a question. It looks to me like trying to put a location somewhere that it will make money.
Tee one up for themselves. Like, we know high-end store placements do well. We don't want to fall on our face in our first foray into the American market. Let's do what we know can work. Or have
it's not experimental. Right. This is not an experimental move.
Yeah. I mean, America's the experiment, so don't do the demographic experiment stuff, I guess. Maybe that's control your variables as much as you can. That would make sense to me. But it also occurred to me, again, I'm not a great retail shopper, and that is an understatement, if you can't hear it in my voice. I don't have a lot of experience with chains that have a lot of variability from location to location, if that makes sense. Like, how variable can it really be? Like, can it really be, can it be Short Hills, New Jersey, 1%, and be the kind of place that goes into your run-of-the-mill Barnes & Noble location in a strip mall in Lenexa? Do you see where I'm getting at there? Like, does that make sense? Do people do that? Maybe I'm sure that someone other than me might have an answer to that. I don't have great experience with that.
There's Barnes & Noble in the suburbs in Overland Park in Kansas City. Geography.
Is the fancy quotient meaningfully different?
Well, but like the fancy quotient of that one on the plaza is higher. It's not as big of a difference as you know, the difference between like the Overland Park Suburban Mall Barnes and Noble and this Indigo would be. But I think there's gradation there.
Okay. Because I thought of the exact same answer. And I was like, well, the goods in the stores are probably about the same and the prices are probably about the same.
Oh, you know, the sidelines are different. Like the books are probably the same, but the sidelines change.
That's
like, this is my understanding of chain retail is that like, right, like it's fun. This is fundamentally a bookstore. They're going to all the Barnes and Nobles are probably going to have basically the same books given the usual variation between like what people in that area are reading, you know, or what they're into. Like that's variable from location to location and city to city. But like the sidelines that you can sell in the suburbs of a working class community are different from the sidelines that you can sell like on the country club plaza where, you know, like the Armani store is down the street.
That's interesting. I guess I was, that makes a lot of sense to me. I guess I was thinking more like, are there handbags or not? Sort of more binary condition, but that's a really good point that the sidelines.
Yeah, it's like, are they
buying
$10?
How fancy are the journals? You know,
right, do you right. have Are you selling pens? Them a $10 right. journal? Mm-hmm. Exactly, a $10 journal. And maybe they have that full range of things in both stores, but the working class neighborhood store has more tote bags that are $10, and the fancy location has the $10 tote bags, but also has like $40 Jonathan Adler candles or something, you know.
You can buy candles for $40? I guess
you Jeff.
Can. I mean, you just said it, so like, why
would... I personally never have, but I am familiar. Yes. The short answer is yes.
I mean, I shouldn't be surprised. You can spend money on everything. Is it marijuana candle? Is that why it's $40? I don't get... I mean, that's a different conversation. $40.
The marijuana candle would probably be less...
That's true.
No, it's there. If you want to go down a rabbit hole, maybe someone has written narrative nonfiction about high-end candles, and then you can read it.
I have read a book about the history of the cost of light, and they didn't mention $40 candles.
Well, which is why I didn't think it was impossible that you would read a history of.
Oh,
candles.
It's not impossible. It's not impossible.
There's a brand called Diptyque that is very fancy.
Oh my god! Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, if it's late at night and you're feeling bad about yourself, you can just, you know, go further by Googling.
Do you ever go to Waxman Candles in Lawrence? Do you ever do that back when?
I think I did. Yeah.
It's like an old, I mean, it's fancier now, but an old hippie kind of a store where they do hand dipped candles. And, you know, they're a couple bucks for the, what they called votives. God, how do I even know that? It's so embarrassing. but like the $40 ones were like these giant, like multi-wick, like sculpted kind of a thing. So, I guess I do have experience with $40 candles. If you know,
it's a luxury.
Yeah,
market.
I guess so. Aromatherapy is what they probably call it, right? Like that's where you get it. That's where you can
probably,
ratchet up the price.
There's
a pseudoscience tax that's applied to it.
Let's move on
to other things. Speaking of pseudoscience. Public voting for awards.
Oh, yep.
The Goodreads Choice Award voting is open now. A little more festive in their branding of this year. I don't know if you noticed the same thing.
A little gold glitter.
Yeah,
it looks exciting.
Right? Yeah. Also, some embedded ads, which, you know, since this is what we do, we notice this sort of stuff too as well. It makes a lot of sense to put this here. You know, I'm in the same boat as I was for the National Book Award long list and the, you know, whatever it is. I haven't read a lot of super new books this year. I guess since there's more, pop nonfiction kinds of categories, meaning humor, science, and technology, you get a little more stratification and fragmentation in those categories. I have more to say about that. There's also a best of the best, which is apparently a thing that's happening now. It's like flavors of Doritos. Mm-hmm. It's multiplying all over the place, people doing these best of the best things. We're 10 years into the Goodreads Choice Awards, so we have 10 years of winners that we can pick the golden booker or what the golden snitch. I can't remember what they're calling the other stuff, but apparently we like to pick the best of the best. That's the thing we can do now. I meant to shoot you this question before we were recording so you can be ready, but is there any of these categories you want to look at together real quick? We can't do them all. There's too many.
Well,
any you'd like to hear me blather about or you'd like to blather to me about?
That's a good question. I clicked open, like I have tabs open for categories that I have read books
okay,
in this year.
Tell me about, pick one or two. Let's talk about them for a minute.
Not literary fiction. Okay, well, let's see. So a couple highlights from food and cookbooks.
Oh, Lord. Okay, great. I don't know anything about this. Well, that's not true. Maybe I have one.
Solidly. Yeah, you do know. Yeah. Solidly in the Shinsky wheelhouse, but Buttermilk
Yeah,
Coffee.
Look at that.
By Edward Lee, which we both loved, is a finalist. And Killing It by Kamas Davis is there. And I didn't see nearly as much conversation about this book as I wanted to. She quit her job as a journalist to become a butcher. Mm-hmm. And she lives in Portland, Jeff.
Oh, really?
So you could go.
Wait, which
yeah,
one is
you
that?
Could go. Killing It by Kamas Davis. It's right next to Buttermilk Graffiti on the Goodreads.
Oh, it's the first thing. I just have blind.
Yeah. She's holding a big cleaver.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the first thing on the list for you because it's not for me. They must be randomizing.
Good for
display,
them.
Which,
speaking of non pseudoscience.
That's nice. I like that. Anyway, she was a journalist. She quit her job to become a butcher because she was tired of writing about the people doing the thing, and she wanted to be the person doing the thing. And she goes to France and studies with, I believe it's France, and like she
sure,
has some connections
yeah.
through people. She ends up in France learning from these folks who run like a family farm and butchery, and she learns like the old traditional ways of butchery and of thinking about like using the whole animal, and then also gets into the modern ethics of the ethics of eating meat, the ethics of raising animals for food and what that means. Mm. And just, it's so thoughtful and interesting. If it felt very in the vein of Hammerhead by Nina McLaughlin to me. So I also think that like you personally would like
well,
it.
Well, there's a whole
reason.
Genre of I quit my job to take on a working class job, which I'm in for.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's some shop class, soul craft elements to it, but just a great book and a fascinating person. So I really liked seeing both of those.
Wait, you can guess. I've read another one of these books we haven't talked about, and it's probably the most boring one on here. Can you guess what it is? It's Mark Kurlansky's History of Milk.
I did love his book about salt,
yeah.
So I cannot.
I read all of them: paper,
stone.
Cod, salt, milk. Anyway,
I mean, I think that his work is the example that, like, if you do it the right way, you can make anything.
Yeah,
really
it's a little bit too much of a page turner for me, Mark Kurlansky.
Yeah, or like reflective, actually, of that most things are interesting when looked at through the right lens.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
That's the way that
if a thing is in the world and the world is interesting, ergo that thing can be interesting because it exists in the world, kind of.
Right.
Idea.
Let's talk about best nonfiction.
Okay.
I think we probably have some.
Where is it? Now this is randomized
there.
For me too. Just nonfiction in general. Oh, here it is.
Yeah, it just says best nonfiction.
Oh yeah, so, I've read several of these actually.
Yeah, the first one on my display is
Mine
Bad Blood.
Mine too. Which did we talk about on the show? Have we talked about it?
I don't know. I talked about it on all the books, but I don't know if we've talked about it.
Here's the thing. I don't know if it's good.
If Bad Blood is good.
Well, I mean, it's a page turner. It's an incredible story. Is it good like beyond that? Like it's well reported. Like is it well written? Is it like does it do a Kurlansky kind of thing of is the degree of difficulty hard, I guess is what I'm trying to get at in terms of a writing project.
You know, I think that it must be good because it's the kind of story that like you and I were going to read no matter what. But I've seen enough different kinds of readers, at least in our community, pick it up and get hooked on it that I have been surprised by. That he does a good job of like we understand how startup culture works. We know some things about how businesses run and how funding things work, and like so we can hear some of the stuff in there that is. Insidery banana pants, but he makes the banana pantsness of it all like very just brings it all
and
right
I guess when you've got
out.
A story that good, just get out of the way. It's like if you're having good ingredients, don't like put I don't know,
it doesn't
cannabis
need,
foam with a a curry sugar cage on it or whatever, like
Bad Blood, right? It doesn't need any
doesn't
razzle,
get out of
dazzle.
The way. And I think I'm amending my I think in that regard it is super skillful and just letting this train on rails run.
Mm-hmm. Where you're just like, what on earth?
It doesn't need to make a 10,000-year narrative out of a dairy product. Like, you've got a good story. Just let it go.
Right. It's just a good... I don't know if it'll stand the test of time.
No.
But it's a... I think it's a great book. So you want to talk about Race by Ijeoma Oluwo is on here. I think that's an essential
read
for anybody who cares about trying to get it right, or even just trying to get it better, in how we talk about race, especially people who are white learning to talk about race with people who are not white and how we address racial issues. Let's see, what else have I read on here? I read part of Enlightenment Now by Steven Pinker, which is a huge book.
Mm-hmm. I want to read that, but the commitment is getting on me.
It's a big commitment. In my experience, it kind of had the Gladwell effect of like, I knew where he was going well before the end of the book. And I was like, I agree with you and I don't need to go any further. But is about the case for reason and science and humanism in this moment. And it was a dose of optimism that I needed at the time that I read it. Mm. Fear by Bob Woodward is on here. Susan Orlean's library book. Did? Not That Bad by Roxane Gay, an essay collection or an anthology of essays by a bunch of people about rape culture. Mm-hmm. I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara about the Golden State Killer, which I listened to on audio, and I am a hearty one, but like I could not.
No, thank you.
You should not go
no
there.
Way.
You should not. It was too creepy. And then Factfulness by Hans Rosling, which I haven't read, but is the book that Bill Gates yes. was giving away to every college graduate this year. It keeps bubbling up now. Like some of this is just Bader Meinhof that I see it everywhere.
I didn't put together there was a new book. For some reason, I thought it was an older book.
I didn't
book.
Either.
I don't,
but there
some
it
sort
is.
Of weird bias that you could give away for free an older book, but a new one would be harder. But anyway, there we go.
Yeah. And, I also have not read Girl, Wash Your Face by Rachel Hollis, but I'm seeing
that
it
book is
everywhere.
Selling. I was looking at Publishers Weekly, mm-hmm. and that book is selling, which is
I'm seeing that one all
not
over
exactly
the place.
Sure, my understanding it's a Christian title of some kind.
Yeah, she's a Christian writer. It's like a Christian kind of feminist inspirational self help is my understanding of
it's
it.
It's not about personal hygiene.
No. Okay. It's like a self-carry kind of book, I think.
I have also read, if you're done with the ones you've read, I read Skin in the Game by Nassim Taleb.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Which, now that it's funny I talk about the bad blood of an interesting topic we get out of the way, this one is a not very well-written or organized book with a really interesting idea at its core. Is that harsh? It's harsh, I guess.
Well, it's honest.
I mean, again, maybe I'm misinterpreting the guy as much smarter than I am, and I think... Maybe I don't know. It seems like I could have done it a different way. It doesn't suffer from the Gladwell effect of being too neat, if I'll put it that way. But like the idea is like there's a sort of an ethical question of how involved and how you should think about weighing in on decision in which you don't have skin in the game, right? Is it ethical to express and have strong opinions about something that really won't affect you? So that you trump other people's reasoning, well, it will affect them. Like, when should you stay out of it? And like, whose kinds of opinions, maybe, and analyses should you think about when trying to make a decision about something that does affect you? Like, you know, one classic example is, people on cable financial news networks making buy and sell declarations. Mm. Does it cost them anything to get it right or wrong?
I was thinking of rooms full of old men making decisions about reproductive health.
Yeah, you could go a whole bunch of different ways, right? And like that, there, and you can tell by the cover, like it's a barbell with a different amount of weight on one side than the other. Like, could you think about giving different weights or weighting different kinds of inputs differently about whether or not that actually affects that person and how it affects that person or how it affects that group, which I think is a really interesting idea.
Is it? Well, we use the language of an interesting mess with each other. Is it interesting enough to be worth the mess? Would you recommend it?
No.
No?
I think maybe I gave you enough right there, frankly, in a way. Like,
all right.
Maybe if you want some specific examples you're finding it hard to do, I feel like I want someone to clean it up a little bit. But as you could tell, I could articulate some interest and a relatively detailed explanation of the idea. It's something I've thought about, right? Like even in a work situation, if someone comes to you a problem and you're like, you know, what should I do about this? Or like, or your immediate inclination is to provide an answer is like, well, does this affect me? And so if it doesn't affect me, why am I offering a solution rather than helping them articulate, you know, what their problems are, what might matter? I think it's a really interesting thing to think about in that regard. And it can be about identity politics. You know, you might think that'd be an obvious place to go with it, but it is and it isn't. Like, there's a whole bunch of situations where I think the skin part is, it's a, it's...
It's a good beat to take.
Yeah, it's a good beat to take. Yeah. But anyway, there's that. I read 21st Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari, which I liked, but I have to say it didn't stick with me. I mean, some of it is how it's organized, okay, that there's like 21 discrete chapters. And I felt like I kind of got a lot of the same stuff out of his follow-up to the first book, which I'm now blanking on which Latin name goes with
Sapiens.
What. Sapiens, right? I liked it. I would recommend it. It was interesting. And then what else? Library book. I don't like to badmouth a book. I felt like, yeah, it's interesting. I think if you like books and you listen to this podcast, you're going to want to read this book. I'm just not sure. It's a good swing and a miss to me, the book. Like, it was kind of all over. It's about this particular library, but libraries in general, and a thought piece. And it has the Orwellian thing of, like, the orchid thief of being about everything, but also what is it about is at the same time. Like, I don't know. Again, I'm also have a weird particular thing because I just, you know, I spent 6 weeks researching the Carnegie Library thing by itself. So my mode, like, this is only like 280 pages and it's called the library book. So I'm like, you can't do that to libraries. I need, you know, like I'm saying, I need the Steven Pinker 1200 page, like,
I need 19 more volumes.
Yeah, right.
Of this.
So I might also be the wrong audience for the right book, if that makes sense.
I got it in the mail and looked at it, and I also don't want to bash it, but I think that I have become not the audience for books.
Yeah, you
books.
Have.
I have lost a lot of like romanticism about books, I guess. And I just don't care. It's a straight shot up the middle for a lot of readers. Or like, if you want to sell a book, you can make it a book about books. That's a category in a lot of things. And I get it. I think I've just seen too much of it. Or it's now like, it looks to me like, oh, I know what you're doing.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, that's why I'm saying, I think for a person who likes books, but doesn't swim around in the muck of it like we do.
Right.
I think there's a real, frankly, that's the right audience. Do not pitch books to people like us.
Right.
That is in this category not going to work. So that's it. So I'm going to make a very idiosyncratic or a disclaimer about my reaction to that one, and fully recognize that there's a high probability that it just me.
I think we can skip the fiction page.
Yeah, I think we're done with that. I think we've done way more than I was expecting to do with the Goodreads Choice Awards, unless there's somewhere else you want to go with it.
Yeah, there's not really. There's a couple things on memoir that I liked. Couple things on, I clicked on science and technology.
Yeah, I did too.
But yeah, interesting. I mean, they're interesting lists, but it's also never like super surprising.
The Goodreads Regression to the Mean Choice Awards. I mean, it is interesting, which is useful, I think, frankly.
And it's not shade on Goodreads. No. Like, that's what happens when giant populations of people weigh in on anything.
I mean, I wouldn't mind having a giant Book Riot Regression to the Mean Choice Award. That means you have millions of people, you know, interacting with your thing. Like, yeah.
May we grow large enough to reach Regression to the Mean.
Wait, may we grow large enough for our awards to be super predictable by math?
That you know what, that is a problem I would love to have.
That's right. It's an old German saying. May you grow large enough that you're statistically predictable. Let's do one more sponsor, and then we've got there are
some potpourri.
Yeah, most interesting story of the week. This episode of the Book Riot Podcast is brought to you by Penguin Random House Audios. Try audiobooks.com. Keep up with your book club reading by listening to the audiobook. Audiobooks are the perfect complement to your busy schedule. Listen to new releases such as The Kennedy Debutante by Carrie Marr and read by Julia Whelan, and you can enjoy a whole new book club experience. For more listening suggestions, visit tryaudiobooks.com/bookriot. That's tryaudiobooks.com/bookriot. Get yourself some picks, find out what's out there. You know, talk to your book club about, you know, did anyone else listen to this book? What'd you think of the performance? That's another like layer to the onion of book discussion. There. And as you know, anyone who's listened to an audiobook knows narrator matters. I've listened to some books just because I like the narrator, and I've quit listening to books I really wanted to listen to because the narrator wasn't click with me. Speaking of Susan Orlean, I was going to listen to The Orchid Thief because I'd never read it, and I could, the narrator, I was like, you know what? Can't do it. Went to print.
Nope.
Mattered. And then I like this narrator that does some other books, and I looked through the back catalog and picked up something randomly and just enjoyed it. It was something I would have picked up I would give the narrator's name right now, but I've forgotten. I don't have it written down in front of me. That's why I feel like it feels like I'm being cagey about it. Because it's not because I'm sophisticated. It's because I'm forgetful.
This is the conclusion that we've just come to in general, right? If you think that something's not happening because the other party is being cagey,
you just don't have a link
probably
ready.
Not. Yeah, they're just not prepared. They just don't know. All right. In the weirdest and also most delightful somehow news of the week, which involves an attempted murder that I don't want to make light of, two scientists who have worked together in Antarctica on a remote, location, spent a harsh 4 years at Russia's isolated Belingshausen station. They've spent time there. They've also spent time in Antarctica. One attacked the other, did stab him, successfully stabbed him, has been charged with attempted murder and became enraged because his colleague kept telling him the end of the books he had read before he read them.
Was reading, right?
Man. Yeah, that like they both became avid readers as a way to deal with, you know, basically the boredom and all the downtime of being scientists in Antarctica. And it was just spoilers. He was just given spoilers. And the other one, there was alcohol involved.
No, you don't say.
I'm sure you'll be shocked that that's what happened. But it came to a head. He couldn't take any more spoilers and he stabbed the guy. And the obviously you should not stab people for any reason. We're not condoning violence, but I get being, I get being upset about ongoing spoilers. That's just not.
Well,
cool.
It's one of those situations where it's kind of not about the book spoiling.
No.
It's kind of just being a jerk, right? And you're isolated.
Like,
imagine the other things that this guy was also doing, probably.
The manifestation of jerkitude here was
I mean,
you know, and this is like, it's a way to needle a person, because I'm sure that this is not the first conversation that they have about, like, dude, stop spoiling.
Yeah,
stuff.
Didn't go from saying it's cool to spoil the books to, like, Knives Out, you know, right away.
Right.
But what. I guess this tells me a couple things. Don't go to Antarctica. Right? I mean...
that would be the lesson you took from it.
What was that story that was about? It was Russians in a bar.
The Russian
about
guys.
Chekhov. Mm-hmm. Remember that? Or Pushkin,
right.
Or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them
murdered
the other one.
One of them pulled a knife.
Do not get into a literary dispute with Russians, because they take it really seriously, I guess. It kind of got passed around the internet and you can, like, in a jokey kind of way, but a dude got stabbed and had to be evacuated, like, kind of dark at the same time. I don't know. I'm worried about how this got passed around.
Yeah, I think, like, you're in a literal and psychologically dark place in Antarctica when this is happening. Like, by the time that you're broken, like, that repeated spoilers about books and whatever else antagonistic behavior was going on between these guys, like, it's not good. There was some delight about how this happened, and of course readers are like, well, I get it, spoilers, but it's also we don't want to make light of it. Not a cool situation.
Yeah, I guess it does highlight, though, that you know, as a way to antagonize someone, this is something you could totally see making someone super mad, though. Like, you kind of get, like, how this could make someone super mad. Like, it's a sign of total disrespect and, you know, willful peeing in the punch bowl. It's just a really bad situation. I've never heard of anything like this. The line that got me was first case of attempted murder in Antarctica.
kind of surprising, actually, given that they're out there.
Yeah, like. I guess you would. I think it's like NASA, though, where they try to do psychological profiling, and maybe one or both of these guys slipped through the goalie of that test, because anyone who would needle someone by telling them the ending of the book shouldn't be with one other person for 4 years in a row.
Agreed.
In Antarctica. You know, just should not be there. I hope everything turns out okay.
Yeah.
I'm worried, but I don't like, again, it sounds weird to say I don't like this story, but it's not as funny as I think some people reading the headline will find out. Not an onion piece. Could be an onion piece.
Right, right.
I think that's part of the problem, is
it's like, it's believable, extreme. Right? Like, that's one of those, like, kernels is like, yeah, of course he got that mad.
Right. Yeah, definitely. All right, well, that's our show. Thanks so much for all of our sponsors this week. Go check out the show notes here. I don't think we have any open questions for listeners. If you've got any Goodreads choice awards feedback. You know, don't give us a rundown of your winner for every one, but if you feel super strongly about one of the books in this category, I think I'd like to know that. podcast@bookriot.com. Can find show notes of this and all back episodes of the Book Riot podcast at bookriot.com/listen. Rebecca, thank you as always.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Talk to you later.